from Park City, Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. This is Democracy Now!
Having grown up in the South, where the cops and the Klan were one and the same, my parents didn't turn to the police for protection. They had already felt that the police had turned their own son into the prime suspect in his own murder.
For the first time in Academy Award history, a trans director has been nominated for an Oscar. We'll speak to Yancey Ford about his documentary, Strong Island. It chronicles what happened to his own family after his brother was shot dead by a white mechanic in Long Island, New York in 1992. The killer never charged. Plus, we hear from Oscar nominee, the musician and actor, Common.
The day the women took over, let it continue. Now women get paid as much as men do. Dr. Angelo looking from heaven's window, telling young girls phenomenal woman is in you. Body is a temple. Men don't pray. Mother Earth's arms around you saying it's okay. Toilet seats down. That's a no-brainer. Monuments in Washington of Fannie Lou Hamer.
Common also stars in a film here at Sundance that's had its world premiere about sexual abuse called The Tale. Then Hale County, This Morning, This Evening, a new documentary captures life in the Black Belt of Alabama. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Switzerland, thousands of protesters took to the streets of Zurich on Tuesday to protest against the World Economic Forum in Davos and President Trump's planned visit. Switzerland's deployed at least 5,000 soldiers and police to Davos. It's also imposed a no-fly zone over the area. The protest came as U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is slated to lead the Davos summit today. Trump is scheduled to arrive tomorrow, becoming the first U.S. president to attend Davos in two decades. This is protester Paolo Ghilardi.
While the Swiss Federal Council is about to welcome and unroll the red carpet for Mr. Trump, well, we think that the people have something to say and that this policy is unacceptable because the goal of this policy is to reduce the planet to fire and blood and to assure the powerful people's domination over the rest of the world.
In news from Capitol Hill, the Justice Department's confirmed Attorney General Jeff Sessions underwent several hours of questioning last week as part of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Mueller's probe is increasingly investigating not only the Trump campaign's ties to Russia, but also President Trump's time in office, including whether he tried to obstruct the Russia investigation. The questioning of Jeff Sessions marks the first time a member of Trump's cabinet faced questioning. The Senate has confirmed multimillionaire banker Jerome Powell to replace Federal Reserve Chairwoman Janet Yellen. Powell is a former partner at the massive investment firm Carlyle Group, which is a major investor in military contractors, as well as telecommunications, fossil fuel companies, financial services, and other industries. His confirmation marks the first time in 40 years someone who's not an economist is leading the Federal Reserve. Immigration rights activists held protests at the offices of several senators Tuesday to protest against lawmakers' passage of a short-term spending bill that did not include any protections for Dreamers. Protesters also gathered outside the home of Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York, who capitulated to Republican lawmakers and voted for the spending bill after having vowed to oppose any bill that did not include a resolution on DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that President Trump rescinded last year. Senator Schumer now says he will no longer back plans to fund President Trump's proposed billion-dollar border wall in exchange for a resolution on DACA. In Kentucky, two high school students were killed, 18 more wounded, after a 15-year-old boy walked into Marshall County High School with a handgun just before 8 a.m. local time Tuesday morning, began shooting his fellow students in the common area. The victims are Bailey Nicole Holt and Preston Ryan Cope, both 15 years old. Five other students are still hospitalized in critical condition. This is Kentucky State Police Commissioner Rick Sanders.
And speaking of the human toll that something like this takes, I can't tell you a whole lot about what happened there today because I don't want to do anything to hurt the investigation, but I will address the human toll it takes. In addition to those family members that have lost loved ones, that have had loved ones injured or hurt or traumatized, we pray for those people.
Tuesday's shooting was the 11th shooting at a U.S. school so far this year, meaning there's been nearly one school shooting every other day across the United States. On Monday, there were two separate school shootings, one inside a school cafeteria outside Dallas, Texas, and another in the parking lot of a charter school in New Orleans. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has announced the city is suing major pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributors over the opioid crisis. Among the companies being sued are Purdue Pharma, which is the maker of OxyContin, and Johnson & Johnson. The opioid crisis killed 64,000 Americans in 2016. Meanwhile, photographer Nan Golden, who's a recovered opioid addict, and a group of her fellow artists and activists have launched a campaign shaming the secretive Sackler family, which owns Purdue Pharma, over their profiting off the opioid crisis. She said, "I don't know how they live with themselves." In Libya, a double car bombing in the city of Benghazi has killed at least 33 people. The first explosion hit a mosque at worshippers were leaving evening prayers. The second bomb exploded only minutes later as health and security officials were arriving at the site of the first blast. In news on Syria, the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS claims it killed more than 150 ISIS fighters in airstrikes Saturday in Syria's southeastern province of Deir ez-Zor. Meanwhile, in the northern Syrian city of Afrin, Turkey is continuing its bombing and ground offensive against the U.S.-backed Kurdish forces who control the region. The United Nations says the Turkish offensive has killed at least 24 civilians, displaced more than 5,000 people since it began on Saturday. The Turkish offensive against Afrin has sparked protests in cities across the world. This is protester Abdul Darwish, who's originally from Afrin, speaking at a protest in Athens.
Right now, there's chaos in Afrin, a battle. He, Tayyip Erdogan, strikes everywhere with airstrikes. He doesn't spare children. He doesn't spare schools. He doesn't spare anything. He strikes everywhere.
Meanwhile, in more news on Syria, the United States has accused the Syrian government of carrying out a chemical weapons attack during its ongoing offensive against the rebel-held enclave of Eastern Ghouta outside the capital, Damascus. This is Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
Only yesterday, more than 20 civilians, most of them children, were victims of an apparent chlorine gas attack. The recent attacks in East Ghouta raise serious concerns that Bashar al-Assad's Syrian regime may be continuing its use of chemical weapons against its own people.
The Syrian government's denied using chemical weapons in the ongoing conflict. In Afghanistan, ISIS has claimed responsibility for an attack on the offices of Save the Children in the eastern city of Jalalabad. At least two people were killed in the attack and a dozen more wounded. The group Save the Children says it's suspending its program operations in Afghanistan. In the Philippines, more than 50,000 people have been forced to flee their homes as Mount Mayon has erupted, throwing lava 2,000 feet in the air. The volcano has been spewing volcanic ash and debris for days. Volcanic ash has filled the sky, blanketing whole villages in darkness. Amnesty International is accusing the Mexican government of breaking Mexican and international asylum law and deporting Central Americans back to their home countries despite threats to their lives. The report cited the case of a Honduran bus driver who was killed 3 weeks after Mexican authorities deported him back to Honduras. This is Amnesty International researcher Madeline Penman.
This return is a violation of Mexican law and international law that consists of returning a person to a territory where their life or safety is in danger. Day after day, despite being afraid of dying, having threats against them, having attacks against them, there are people from Central America who are being returned to face a possible death.
Back in the United States, in Michigan, authorities arrested a 19-year-old white man named Brandon Grissomer after he reportedly called CNN's headquarters nearly two dozen times, threatening to murder workers, using slurs to insult African Americans and Jews. His threats reportedly included saying, "Fake news, I'm coming to gun you all down, I'm on my way right now to gun the effing CNN cast down," unquote. He was arrested and charged on Friday, but as journalist Sean King notes, he was released only hours later on bail, despite the fact Reismer has admitted to also making threatening and insulting calls to a Michigan Islamic center only a few months ago. As Sean King writes in The Intercept, quote, Reismer, you see, is a dangerous bigot, but he's also white. And because of his whiteness, he's already free on just $10,000 bond. In California, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors has voted to end the celebration of Christopher Columbus Day. This makes San Francisco the latest of more than 50 cities across the U.S. to stop honoring the Italian explorer who massacred and enslaved Arawak indigenous people and opened the door to the European colonization of the Americas. San Francisco, like other cities, will now celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday in October. Civil rights leader Reverend Wyatt T. Walker has died at the age of 88. The Reverend was Martin Luther King Jr.'s chief of staff, the first full-time executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was also a major anti-apartheid activist. He died Tuesday in his home in Chester, Virginia. And celebrated fantasy novelist Ursula Le Guin has also died at the age of 88. The feminist writer was the author of more than 20 novels, more than a dozen collections of poetry, and another dozen children's books. Among her most famous works was her 1969 novel, The Left Hand of Darkness. It's set on a planet where people are ambisexual, neither male nor female, and contains one of the most famous sentences ever written in a fantasy novel. The king was pregnant. Ursula Le Guin's 1974 novel, The Dispossessed, is also one of the most celebrated explorations of utopia, dystopia, capitalism, anarchism, and oppression. This is Ursula Le Guin accepting the National Book Foundation's Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters in 2014.
I think hard times are coming when we will be wanting the voices of writers who can see alternatives to how we live now, and can see through our fear-stricken society and its obsessive technologies to other ways of being, and even imagine some real grounds for hope. We will need writers who can remember freedom, poets, visionaries, the realists of a larger reality. We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, and very often in our art, the art of words.
Ursula Le Guin died on Monday at her home in Portland, Oregon, at the age of 88. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. The 2018 Academy Award nominations marks a historic first. Yancey Ford became the first trans director to be nominated for an Academy Award. His film, Strong Island, is up for Best Documentary. Ford is African-American, chronicling what happened to his own family after his brother, William Ford Jr., was shot dead by a white mechanic in Long Island, New York, in 1992. The killer was questioned by police, but never charged. This is the trailer for Strong Island.
You stumble out of the garage and into the yard, where you fall.
I said to the officer, "Where is my son? I want to be with my son."
You lie on the ground, bullet through your heart, and know you will never see your sisters again, your mother, your father. That was the beginning.
I did not feel that we were received as parents of a victim.
Our blackness and how to survive being black in America was something that our parents instilled in us extraordinarily well.
No officer spoke to me. No officer would look at me.
You hear that your son is being investigated, and you grow more and more afraid.
police to turn my brother into the prime suspect in his own murder.
Your father said to me, these are vicious people. Your son was shot down like a dog.
This kid is going to actually get away with murder.
I'm not willing to discuss any of my prior cases with anybody.
My brother was not armed, not violent. In no way is his death justifiable. 23 white people will decide no crime has even been committed.
It was like all the sand left the world.
I'm not willing to accept that someone else gets to say who William was.
That's the trailer to Strong Island, which has just been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. We're joined now in New York by Democracy Now! Video Stream by the film's director, Yancey Ford, who worked on this documentary for a decade. We're also joined here in Park City at the Sundance Film Festival, where Yancey just was, by Jocelyn Barnes, who produced Strong Island. She's co-founder of Louverture Films with Danny Glover. Yancey Ford and Jocelyn Barnes, we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Yancey, first of all, congratulations. You've not only been nominated for an Oscar, but you have made history as the first trans director to ever be nominated by the Academy.
Thank you, Amy, and good morning. I'm flabbergasted, I have to be honest with you. Strong Island has been a labor of love and dedication on the part of so many people. That it's just an incredible recognition to be honored and to be the first trans director, and I believe the first African-American trans director to be nominated for an Academy Award is incredibly, incredibly special to me.
I want to go to a video posted on Twitter on Tuesday.
Oh,
as the Oscar nominees were being announced. We were actually live broadcasting Democracy Now! Here in Park City. But this is how Yancey Ford and his partner reacted to the news.
Last man in Aleppo.
Did they even say it?
So there is Yancey and his partner responding to being named as an Oscar nominee. Well, Yancey, let's talk about this film and this journey you've taken that actually started long before you even started making the film. First of all, tell us what Strong Island means, the title.
Well, Strong Island is slang for Long Island, New York. And it really grew out of what may surprise people. It really grew out of the very vibrant hip-hop scene that, you know, is located and still, you know, generates artists out of Long Island. So Strong Island, you know, for kids, for hip-hop heads, is a term that's always been used to refer to this place where kids from the city, you know, moved to the suburbs, but still wanted to hang on to, you know, I think a part of their urban heritage. So that's where Strong Island, that's where Strong Island comes from.
And tell us the story of your family. Talk about what happened in 1992 to your brother, William.
Well, in 1992, my brother and his girlfriend got into a car accident. My brother negotiated, you know, with his girlfriend and the mechanic who hit her car that the shop would, you know, repair it if his girlfriend didn't report the accident to her insurance company or the police. Fast forward about 2.5 months later, my brother, on the night of April 7th, after my mother and his girlfriend picked up the car from the garage and brought it home and were followed home, frankly, by someone from the garage. He went to the garage to confront the owner, a man named Tom Daitre Jr. At some point during his confrontation with the owner, which wasn't physical, it was actually a threat to come back to the garage when he became a law enforcement officer, and to reveal what was going on at the place. It was a known chop shop, and to shut the place down. Mark Riley made himself visible to William. He walked out of the garage, and William saw him and recognized him as the person who had cursed out my mother and his girlfriend on a previous visit to the garage. William, and he sort of comes out, goes right back in. William follows him, turns the corner, and essentially is shot. And someone, stumbles back out into the yard, where he sort of collides with his friend Kevin, who heard the gunshot and ran toward William. He fell to the ground and essentially bled to death internally by the time he got to Stony Brook University Hospital. Mark Riley was brought before a grand jury in August of that year, an all-white grand jury. And despite what people who have been both inside and outside of prosecutor offices have told me about the case, they, and their analysis of the case, that grand jury declined to return an indictment. And so Mark Riley went home without facing trial. And my family was left to essentially deal with the fallout and failure of this civic institution that we had all, been raised to believe, would work for us if we, followed the old American rules, right? Like, you behave, you work, and the justice system will work for you when you need it. And my brother's case 25 years ago simply affirms what we are seeing now, which is it doesn't matter if you follow the rules. The justice system isn't meant to work for people of color in this country.
I want to go to another clip from Strong Island. Yancey, this is you, because you're one of the subjects in the film.
Countless number of times, at all hours of the night, during the summer after my brother was killed, I could look outside the window and there was a car parked across the street. That car and whoever was in that car was watching our house and trying to intimidate my parents. The phone rang in the middle of the night, every night, for months. When I was home, I unplugged all of the phones in the house, except for the one in my room, so that my parents could sleep through the night, so that they wouldn't have to pick up the phone and say hello and not have anyone respond, so that they wouldn't have to hang up the phone and go to the window and see the car sitting across the street.
Having grown up in the South, where the cops and the Klan were one and the same, my parents didn't turn to the police for protection. They had already felt that the police had turned their own son into the prime suspect in his own murder.
So, Yancey, that is you in the documentary. The interviews with you, with your sister, with your mother are heartbreaking, are so deeply profound as you talk about the death of your brother William, also the death of your family. But how did you go from the murder of your brother to the concept behind this documentary, what you wanted to convey with this? You also used it to investigate your brother's death.
That's right. Amy, I think that there are very few people who intersect with issues so personally. And I realized that that intersection, that my experience losing my brother and losing my family in the aftermath of his death, I started making the film 15 years after he, was killed. And I decided that the narrative of his life had been completely rewritten by someone whose, essentially whose freedom was at stake. And I needed to correct that record. I needed to, reveal who William was, but I also needed to reveal the way in which he was essentially criminalized. And so what I decided to do with this film was to put black characters in the center of the frame and to have their experiences verified by themselves. There's no outside, authority in this film that says, yes, you're right, or these people are telling the truth. It was very important to me conceptually that the film be driven by black characters, because so often black people and brown people and folks who lose unarmed loved ones to violence, they get shoved out of the way as if they are somehow, unreliable witnesses to the lives of their dead. And in fact, the people in the film, William's best friend, Kevin, who was with him the night that he was shot, Harvey, who knew him from Howard University, they are the most reliable people because they are able to talk about William in his full complexity, as opposed to reducing William to this stereotype, which if you listen to the detective in the film, you would think that my brother was the Incredible Hulk, when really my brother was 5'8" tall and described by the coroner as obese. So the entire, the driving motive, one of the driving motives behind Strong Island is to reveal William as a whole, as a 360-degree character, including his faults. And by doing so, still saying, despite all of his faults, despite the fact that he might not have been the perfect black victim, this killing was still unlawful and should have gone to trial.
Yancey Ford, you ask in this documentary, how do you measure the distance of reasonable fear? Explain.
Well, reasonable fear is the concept that says you are justified in responding to a threat, with deadly force if your life is at stake. And it's the sort of the driving question of, in the film, because, New York is not actually a stand your ground state. This is not one of those states. New York is a state that is governed by laws of proportional force, right? So for my brother to be unarmed and to confront a mechanic and for him to, shoot him, despite the fact that William didn't have a weapon, it raises the question of how deeply seated the fear of the black body is, the fear of black men is in our culture, so much so that a grand jury would believe that it was justifiable to shoot and kill an unarmed man when, Mr. Riley had many other choices that night, and his choices weren't scrutinized. My brother's choices were scrutinized. And so I think it's important to interrogate how you measure reasonable fear and who gets to decide whose fear is reasonable. Because we see in these cases that more often than not, the person who has the justification or who has the historical fear, as Jocelyn has explained, when talking about the film, actually the historical fear belongs to the person of color who winds up dead, not to the white person who overreacts with deadly force in these situations.
We're going to go to break, and then we're going to bring Jocelyn Bards into the conversation. We're talking to Yancey Ford, who just made history, the first trans director, the first trans African-American director as well, to be nominated for Academy Award. This is Democracy Now! We'll continue to talk about his documentary, Strong Island. Stay with us.
Da vueltas y vueltas a la casa, da vueltas al derecho y al revés. Tú estaba, se quema, se quema, se quema. Estaba quemado como un tizón. Oh, 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 oh. ¿Quién romperá el círculo? Oh, 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 oh. ¿Quién saltará mi mano? Oh, 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 oh. ¿Quién será mi amante en todo el occidente? Abre el círculo redondo y fuera. Sepárate y salta y pasa por los valles bajando y las colinas doradas de hierba. Oh, 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 oh. ¿Quién romperá el círculo? Oh, 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 oh. ¿Quién saltará mi mano? Oh, 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 oh. ¿Quién será mi amante en todo el occidente?
Music. All in the Western Land by Alvaro Barrioso. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. And as we broadcast our show on Tuesday, the Oscar nominations were announced. It was just about two-thirds of the way through the show, and it was there that we learned that Yancey Ford had made history, the first trans director to be nominated for an Academy Award for his film Strong Island. We're also joined, in addition to Yancey Ford from his home in Queens, New York, we're joined by Jocelyn Barnes, the producer of Strong Island. I just asked Yancey that question, what is the measure of reasonable fear? Mm-hmm. Use that as a launching point to talk about why you got involved, your film company, L'Ouverture Films, and the philosophy behind it.
Thanks, Amy. Yeah, I think this is a really important aspect of the film, this questioning of what underpins self-defense cases and how racialized perception is intertwined with the justice system and who gets to decide what is reasonable fear, and then flipping that question, flipping that perspective to talk about whose fear is actually reasonable from, you know, really bringing the historical element and bringing this question of loss and grief and entwining that in our own interrogation with history, with the historical weight of loss that has been the experience of the African-American community. I think our company was created to offer different perspectives, particularly perspectives that have been marginalized, but which are more and more important, which are more important than ever, I should say, in today's conversation. And Yancey is a truth teller, and our relationship to the truth and who tells the truth, I think, has become even more important.
Now, as Yancey made this film over a decade, more and more police killings were being made public. I won't say they increased. I'll say they were getting more attention.
Yeah.
So you both decided to edit the film outside of the United States?
Yeah, there was a point where Yancey had a cut of the film. Yancey had been working on the film for 4 years when I came into the project and joined Yancey. And we were in dialogue for about a year. He had put the film on hold for a while to decide how to reconceive the film. I think he felt that the film was sitting in the house of grief and that there was no place to move from grief. And so we made a decision to edit, to start the edit from scratch. And there were killings, continuously. And we decided to leave the country and actually go overseas so that he could concentrate and fully focus on the creative element. We went to Denmark. There was a great editor who was available there at the time, Janis Billeskov Jensen, who had worked on The Act of Killing with Joshua Oppenheimer. And we decided that this was Yancey and Janis met for 4 days together, interrogated each other, and decided that they could work together. And I think that was a very difficult decision to make and very risky decision to take. But I think that Yancey, for me, it was important that Yancey was making the film that he wanted to make. And, you know, people refer to the film as personal. And I think that, of course, that is true. But personal is also the language of the dispossessed. In this case, nobody wants to make a film about the killing of their brother. This is an artist who I think really understood that violence, doesn't confer what it promises, and actually decided to use narrative and cinema to recuperate what was possible through narrative, just really seize the field that way.
Strong Island is about the killing of an African-American man in Long Island, New York. The murder of an African-American man by a white mechanic. That man, the white mechanic, was never even charged. A central figure in this documentary is Yancey's mother. And I want to turn to a clip of Strong Island of Yancey's mom.
Your father said to me, don't do anything to hurt my daughters. Don't do anything to hurt my girls. These are vicious people. Your son was shot down like a dog. You're not going to be with them always. I'm not with them always. The girls are all we have left. I wanted him to be angry. I wanted him to be outraged. I wanted him to... I wanted him to get a gun. To avenge my son's death. He became silent.
That's a clip from Yancey Ford's documentary, Strong Island. That's Yancey Ford's mother. Talk about your mother and how important she is to your family and to understanding what happened to William Ford, your brother, and what didn't happen to his murderer.
You know, my mother is shown in the film in her kitchen, right, which is the center of our home and the center of, the place where I grew up. And contrary to what we often see, in the news, right, which is Black people in their state of grief, but not in the place where they are fully aware of an analysis of what is happening and the structural failures and an analysis of the structural failure. My mother is wholly able to explain what happened to our family. She's wholly able to, explain what she saw, in the meetings with the DA and during her testimony before the grand jury. And her analysis was spot on. She wrote a letter to, the district attorney, saying that they hoped for a full, fair, and impartial investigation because we too are the people. And that full, fair, and impartial investigation should have resulted in the case going to trial. It didn't. And when that happened, my mother was also able to say, that she made the mistake of raising her children to believe that they should judge people by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. And I think that that is probably one of the bravest things I've ever heard anyone say. And the fact that she happens to be my mother notwithstanding, because it tells the truth about America, where you cannot actually assume that you are safe with certain people. You cannot actually assume that someone does not have malintent. And you can't actually assume that someone doesn't actually have a murderous fear of you. And that's why she's so powerful in the film, because even though she has lost her firstborn son, her only son, she is still able to speak through that grief to a greater truth, which is her child should not have been lost without his right to due process being violated. And these incomplete investigations, these slipshod investigations, are actually a violation of due process for the dead, because the investigations are the only thing that can speak for them. And by being able to, you know, talk about her entire experience, both critically and emotionally, my mother demonstrates that, you know, Black and brown people are fully aware of the injustices with which we struggle and the structural failures that need to be addressed in our criminal justice system.
I want to turn to another clip of your mom in Strong Island. This is Yancey Ford's mother speaking about the loss of her son, William.
I thought that I could comfort your father, or in that he would comfort me. But he turned his back. I will over. And he couldn't go any further. He couldn't go any further. So I got up and I walked around the bed and I got in front of him. I just said, it's not your loss. It's our loss. We together created this child. God granted him to us for these years. You can't grieve an issue that came from my body and shut me out. And we both cried. He embraced me. And we both cried. And that's how we went to sleep.
Yancey Ford, this is your mother in Strong Island. But in interviewing your mother, what did you learn about her that you didn't know in all the years of living with her and knowing her?
You know, I learned so much about my mother throughout making this film. I think that one of the things, though, the most important thing that I learned about her was that this thing, you know, this sort of demand from my parents that my brother, sister, and I love each other no matter what. You know, they used to say, we're not going to be here someday. And when we're gone, you guys are, you know, you are the only family you will have. And the fact that she not only, you know, taught us and instilled in us, and my father as well, this notion of unconditional love, the fact that that love, you know, carried her through 20 years of grief, love for my sister and I, you know, the fact that her love for my father began in the sixth grade, and the fact that her love for my brother was as present in each interview as it was if he were still alive. She was this amazing, she was this amazingly eloquent woman who ultimately believed in the power of love to heal. But this was the one thing, this injustice was the thing that love couldn't actually heal. I think that she was glad to have the opportunity to speak her truth to power, but love wasn't enough to repair the breach with our civil society. And seeing her disappointment and knowing how deeply it affected her, it was a difficult thing, but also knowing that she was a woman who felt love deeply and who was deeply loved. It was an incredible thing to see, and an incredible gift that, you know, she gave to me.
Yancey, as we wrap up, you transitioned after making this documentary. And I was wondering if you can talk about that process.
You know, Amy, actually, my transition was in progress while I was making the film. And, you know, I had top surgery, I think, 3 years ago this month, actually. And I've always been gender nonconforming. I, you know, identified as a butch lesbian, when I was in my early 20s, even though I, you know, didn't encounter the word transgender, until 1995 when I met, Minnie Bruce Pratt. So, you know, transitioning, sort of in my public, you know, in my private life is something that had been, you know, had been ongoing. And the tricky thing about making a film when you're a character, right, is that you can't actually have your voice change in the middle of post-production, because, you know, I might need to record, you know, additional, lines or re-record things. So, I didn't, begin hormones until, after the picture was locked, but, you know, I had the there's no turning back from here. You know, as the medical establishment tries to, you know, make trans people go through these steps just in case you change your mind, you know, that for me was the easy part. And, you know, being the first trans director, you know, nominated for an Academy Award, you know, having gone through a process with people who embraced me regardless of how I identified, you know, with people who were able to turn on a dime, and use the proper pronouns and respect, my gender identity, even though it's been something, you know, it's not new to me. It's not new, you know, to the people that I hold dear, but it's sort of new in the public space. You know, having that embraced and being respected, you know, by my creative team, you know, as that process played itself out, was tremendously important, because, you know, that respect, you know, for both, you know, me as an artist and me as someone who, was coming to a new understanding of how I wanted to be in the world, right? Which is my true self, my authentic self. And being that authentic self and being out, as my authentic self is so important. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so proud of Strong Island, because the film stands on its own, and also allows, you know, it to go into communities where it might not otherwise go, because of who I am, right? Like, I know that trans people of color are murdered at such rates, you know, in this country every year, and it should be treated as, you know, a law enforcement priority, but it's not. And, you know, if my nomination can help in any way, you know, to advance the issues of trans equality, and protection for, LGBTQ people under the law, then, you know, I'm as humbled by that, as I am by the nomination.
Yancey Ford, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And again, congratulations for making history in different ways, because this documentary, Strong Island, is historic. Yancey Ford, the first trans director to be nominated for an Academy Award for his film, Strong Island. He's received many awards for it so far, his debut film, including the 2017 Special Jury Award for Storytelling at the Sundance Film Festival. It was the most awarded documentary of 2017. And I want to thank Jocelyn Barnes, who will stay with us, because Strong Island debuted last year here at the Sundance Film Festival. This year, another remarkable film, Hale County, this morning, this evening. We'll talk about that next with Ramel Ross and Jocelyn Barnes. Stay with us. Glory.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon. Formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all, just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, they woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up. One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, glory.
Glory. Glory.
Oh.
Glory. Glory.
Now the war is not over. Victory isn't won. We'll fight on to the finish. Then when it's all done, we'll cry. Now for every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people.
Glory by Common and John Legend from the movie Selma. Common, who won an Oscar for that song 2 years ago. Well, on Tuesday this week, he was nominated for another Oscar for his song Stand Up for Something from the film Marshall about Thurgood Marshall. We'll air our interview with Common. I spoke to him in the midst of a snowstorm on Saturday at the Women's March here in Park City, Utah, later in the week. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Park City, Utah, from the Sundance Film Festival. 2 weeks before he was assassinated, 50 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spent the night in Hale County, Alabama, in the heart of the Black Belt of Alabama. He came to Greensboro March 21st, 1968, in an effort to rally support for his Poor People's Campaign. Supporters of King had to hide him in a small wooden house on the outskirts of Greensboro as members of the Ku Klux Klan tried to hunt him down. It would be the last time King was in Hale County, Alabama. 2 weeks later, he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. The safe house where King stayed is now a museum. Well, Hale County is the subject of a new documentary here at Sundance Film Festival. It's titled Hale County This Morning, This Evening. The documentary looks at life in the predominantly African-American county, which is named after a Confederate general. In the film, director Ramel Ross paints an impressionistic portrait of life in the Black Belt in the 21st century. Ramel Ross joins us here in Park City, along with the film's producer, Jocelyn Barnes, who's the co-founder of Louverture Films. Your film is not about Dr. King 50 years ago. It is about people today who live there. People have described you as the Walker Evans of today plus. I mean, and in fact, you started as a photographer. Talk about this highly unusual film, both in form and content.
Well, the film comes out of a sort of desire to centralize the African-American gaze. I came to Hale County sort of spontaneously and really began to look back at my life as an African-American in the U.S. and sort of understood the South as a conceptual home for the African-American. And sort of through that investigation process was using photography to sort of illustrate or investigate or explore the way in which my perception was gracing the landscape. And so I met two wonderful fellas, Daniel Collins and Quincy Bryant, and began filming their lives at some point and began to use the camera to really look, to really, really look for a really long time and see what unfolds through this process of staring. And, you know, it sort of, the film, in some ways, puts forth a goal of giving attention, visual attention, outside of traditional means to the African-American community.
Well, explain what you mean and how you made the transition from photography to film.
So I was making large format images, which is a 4x5 camera, sort of in the tradition of Walker Evans and William Christenberry, some of those other guys. And it's a really slow process. Where you're looking in a ground glass and you have a little sheet over your head and you're like really staring and trying to work the focus out. And in looking that way, for such a long time and with such detail, in some ways, what happens in front of you begins to sort of disintegrate in non-traditional means. And I like to use the example of when you look at a word and the letters sort of, disassociate, and you're like, what am I looking at? People don't do that when they look at people. They don't allow the social construction of, you know, the culture or their race or whatever to sort of break apart. And specifically not to the African-American community. And so the camera, as it's time-based, allows you to spend the time looking in that way. And it's amazing what unfolds or what sort of emerges from that process.
I mean, as you talk about Walker, everyone's looking at a review, and the reviews have been rave for Hale County. From The Hollywood Reporter, they write that photographer Walker Evans and writer James Agee composed Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, their famed text and image study of Great Depression-afflicted sharecroppers in Hale County. But there's not a single close-up of an African-American face in any of Evans' photos. Mm-hmm. You turn that on its head. You give us a very different picture. Jocelyn Barnes, you produced this film. Why was Rommel's work so unusual for you that you wanted to be a part of this project?
Mm-hmm. I just want to clarify, I produced the film with Rommel and also with Sue Kim, another producer. I think of documentary as an encounter, and one of the most unusual elements of this film is not only the centrality of the African-American perspective, but a completely new imaging of African Americans. It really takes apart the historical, it brings the historical to bear on it, but it also takes it apart. And part of this, the strategy, was really in the editing process. It's the looking and the durational aspect of the looking that Rommel brought to this. It opened up a space of reflection, I think, for the viewer to enter and, you know, either make sense of their own experience or actually come into something new. But the editing pattern is associative. So he opened up interstitial space. And that is like, it works in a kind of neurological way where you can follow the grammar of the film, but it also undermines the way that you have been conditioned to look. And it's poetic and it's metaphorical, and that lets you drop your some of your conditioned responses and see differently.
Some people may have focused on Alabama, outside Alabama, for the first time with a special election of a sexual predator, Roy Moore, who just barely lost to the Democrat. But you give us a picture of everyday life in Alabama. Talk about storytelling in a time of Trump, Rommel. We just have less than a minute.
Well, I think, you know, it's not only the stories we tell, it's how we tell the stories, and it's also what is the material of the story. What is the arc of the story? And I think, in this time of Trump, a thing that I personally focused on is not focusing so much on those beginning to end, but all of those middles that are traditionally sort of neutered in order to get to that end. It's almost like corporate language in which every word has some goal, or some instructional goal. But in that, specifically in relationship to blackness, you reduce it to its end goal and therefore sort of don't allow the beauty of being, the beauty of the human in the story to be something larger than its arc or be something larger than the trajectory of whatever you're trying to explain or whatever you're trying to convey.
Well, this, I hope, is just the beginning of our conversations. I want to thank you so much. Congratulations on your film. Rommel Ross, director, cinematographer, editor, Hale County, this morning, this evening, and Jocelyn Barnes, a very happy birthday to Jirena Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.